You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, free COVID tests, new mask recommendations, and the latest from Congress. All on the Friday News Roundup. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, earlier this week, Republicans used the Senate filibuster to stop major voting rights legislation from moving forward. Though Democrats in the Senate could have voted to change the filibuster and advance the measure, they didn't have support from each member. The holdouts were Senators Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona. This is just the latest in a long history of the filibuster in the U.S. Senate. We wanted to look back at how the tool has been used, how it's changed, and how it's sometimes been worked around by both parties. You can join in at 800-642-1234. When you think of the Senate filibuster, what comes to mind? What do you think of the changes in the filibuster over the years? Do you think that Democrats should have gotten rid of it or changed it to enable the passage of this particular voting legislation? Or do you think it is a good idea? It makes it harder to make big changes. Call in with your thoughts or your questions on the U.S. Senate and the filibuster at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. David Cannon is a political science professor and Leon Epstein faculty fellow at UW-Madison. He's an expert on American political institutions, in particular Congress. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be with you, Rob.
Can you remind us, first of all, in basic terms, what the filibuster tool is, as of right now, anyway?
So the filibuster allows for unlimited debate in the Senate, and it's been a rule that's been in place since 1806 in the Senate. And there was actually no way to even stop debate until the cloture motion was invented in 1917. So that's been around for a little over 100 years. And that's the way you stop a filibuster. And that's where today we have this 60 vote threshold needed to stop a filibuster. So today a senator will announce, I'm going to filibuster a bill. If you want to bring that bill back to life, you have to get 60 senators on board to be able to stop that filibuster. Now, the rule has been changed over the decades. Sometimes it was two-thirds of the total number of senators. Sometimes it was two-thirds of those present and voting. They lowered it to 60 vote threshold in 1975. So that's been basically the system we've had in place since 1975, is that 60 votes to stop a filibuster.
I want to track back in the history there. In that original system, if I'm hearing you right, it would take exactly one senator to stop a vote, right? If I could keep going and delaying a vote and they couldn't vote to stop me, that's all it took?
That's right. And so, yeah, from 1806 is when they got rid of the motion to recommit. It's what the House of Representatives has, which is a way of cutting off debate. And that's a simple majority vote in the House to do that. They used to have that in the Senate for the first couple decades of the Senate. And then they got rid of it because they thought, oh, we don't need this. It was actually Aaron Burr, the person who came up with the idea of getting rid of the motion to recommit. And so they ended up having that filibuster in place then, all the way up until 1917. There was no way you could stop it. Now, of course, no single person could hold the floor forever. And it was, honestly, it was not invoked that often. It was pretty unusual for someone to use the unlimited debate in order to sort of, gridlock the system.
Talking to David Cannon, political science professor at UW-Madison, looking at the Senate and the filibuster. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see the filibuster changed? Why? What case would you make for or against getting rid of it? Or what questions do you have? 800-642-1234 is the number, or email ideas@WPR.org. A lot of the focus this last week has been on Democrats in the U.S. Senate in particular, a couple of key senators saying they didn't want to change it. I want to give a listen to Senator Kyrsten Sinema, mentioned her a few minutes ago. She gave a speech on Thursday of last week where she laid out her opposition to doing anything to the filibuster in order to pass voting rights legislation. Here's a little of what she said, making a point about bigger problems.
And while I continue to support these bills, I will not support separate actions that worsen the underlying disease of division infecting our country. The debate over the Senate 60 vote threshold shines a light on our broader challenges. There's no need for me to restate my longstanding support for the 60 vote threshold to pass legislation. There's no need for me to restate its role protecting our country from wild reversals in federal policy.
And that's an argument made, David, for the filibuster, protecting the country, she says, from wild reversals in federal policy, making it harder to swing things back and forth as party control over the Senate changes. Can you talk about that that argument?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, there's certainly something to that. If you have a 60-vote threshold, it makes it harder to change policy than if you have a simple majority of 51 in the Senate. And so it is harder to have policy swing back and forth with a supermajority threshold. But I think what she sort of misses there is another really important part of the filibuster we haven't talked about yet. And that is the deviation from the longstanding practice of the talking filibuster. And, you know, some of your listeners might know the classic movie, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, Jimmy Stewart, you know, holding forth on the floor of the Senate. In the old-fashioned kind of filibuster, the way that, you know, Strom Thurmond did, who still holds the modern-day record of 24 hours and 18 minutes in 1957, trying to kill a civil rights bill in 1957. So that was the old-fashioned way of holding a filibuster, where you actually would have to talk. Well, starting in 1970, they actually implemented a two-track system, where if you wanted to filibuster a bill, it would just go on the filibuster track, and the rest of the business of the Senate could go forward. And so this idea that the filibuster is somehow, you know, preventing wild swings back and forth from legislation really rarely happened back in the old traditional system of the talking filibuster that was in place until 1970, because the filibuster was rarely used. Like it was used sometimes between 0 and 7 times from the 1930s up through 1970. It didn't come into play that often. So only recently, when you have this filibuster track where a senator just has to announce, I'm going to filibuster this bill, and it basically is dead unless you can get that 60 votes to bring it back to life through the cloture vote. Only since that time have we actually seen the filibuster used as an actual threshold to pass all major legislation. So this is something that's, you know, not one of these traditions that goes back to 1806, the way that some senators talk about it.
Tuesday night of this week, Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota talked on MSNBC's The Last Word. Here's what she said about the way the filibuster works now.
We are actually not talking about getting rid of the filibuster, even though if left to my own Lawrence, I would do that. We're actually talking about reforming the rules of the Senate and taking what is essentially a secret process where literally people just stop the vote. They make it so you can't actually get to a conclusion of an issue and they go home or raise money or whatever. That, as I said, is not how this place is supposed to work. So we're taking what is essentially a secret behind closed doors process and making it public with the standing filibuster.
David, what do you think of that idea of getting rid of that filibuster track you just mentioned a few minutes ago and making somebody actually do something to maintain a filibuster?
Exactly. So that's exactly what Senator Klobuchar is talking about, is going back to the way it was before 1970. And so getting rid of that filibuster track, that's the secret process she's talking about. And the standing filibuster is what people often refer to as the talking filibuster. That's what she's talking about bringing back. And I think she's on solid ground there, because, if you look at the historic evidence, back when the cost of a filibuster was high, both in physical terms, you'd have to sit up there, you know, and talk for 24 hours or however long you could hold the floor, and in terms of the business of the Senate, that it stopped everything in the Senate. If you were filibustering a bill, nothing else could happen on the floor of the Senate. Whereas today, with that separate track, it just the rest of the business of the Senate goes on. And so there's really no cost to a filibuster. And so I think Klobuchar is exactly right. If you went back to that older system of the standing or talking filibuster, it would raise the cost of doing a filibuster. And so we would go back from, you know, today we have as many as, you know, 200, 300 different filibusters in every session of Congress. We'd go back to having, you know, single digit filibusters. So it'd be a rare, unusual thing instead of a common everyday occurrence.
We're talking about the past, present, and future of the U.S. Senate and the filibuster with UW-Madison political science professor David Cannon. And now we want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. Were you following the twists and turns this week that led to a filibuster of voting rights legislation earlier this week? What did you think about that process? Do you want to see some kind of change in the filibuster, getting rid of it completely, making it so you have to do something so the Senate comes to a stop so that filibusters are used more rarely? Or do you like the idea that you need, in effect, 60 senators to vote to make just about anything happen? Some exceptions to that. We'll get to those in a minute. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with David Cannon, political science professor at UW-Madison, expert on Congress. We're talking about the filibuster. It was just used by Republicans this week to stop Democrats from moving forward with voting rights legislation and an effort by many Senate Democrats to change the filibuster. That effort fell short. You could join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. If you support Democrats and their congressional agenda, do you want to see them loosen up, weaken the filibuster in some way to pass things? Or do you worry that someone else, Republicans, could use that in the future? If you're a Republican, do you want to see things stay the way they are? Wherever you are across the spectrum, let us know what you think. Or call in with your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's bring on a caller now. Kevin is with us in Janesville. Kevin, hi.
Hi. My comment is, if they want to keep that 60-vote supermajority threshold, then we've got to go back to the standing filibuster. You got to earn it. Do the work. Let people see that that's what's going on. If there's 300 filibusters a year, I believe that's more filibusters per year than they are serving days per year. Thank you.
Kevin, thanks for the call. David.
Yeah, good point by Kevin there that, yeah, there's more filibuster, more than one filibuster a day in terms of the number of days there in session. Yeah, so I completely agree with him that I think that that would be the way to reduce the number of filibusters, is to actually make it costly again to do it rather than just having that filibuster track that you can put a bill on.
Thanks for that call, Kevin. Let's talk about some circumstances, David, where the filibuster doesn't apply. First of all, reconciliation. Republicans used it, I believe, to pass the Tax Cut and Jobs Act back in 2017. Tried to use it to repeal the Affordable Care Act, fell short because of John McCain. Democrats have used it to pass a COVID relief bill this year, but fell short on the Build Back Better Act with one senator standing in the way. Why is reconciliation a way around the filibuster?
Right. So that's one of the major exceptions, is the reconciliation process, which is tied to the annual budget resolution. And so it's a limited tool because it only can happen once a year, and it has to be directly related to the budget, to the budget resolution. And so you only get one shot to do that. And so, like, Obamacare also is another piece of major legislation they passed through reconciliation back when President Obama's healthcare bill passed. And so it's something that is a major exception, but again, it's limited in that you can only do it once a year. And so it's not something that's sort of a common workaround the filibuster.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Richard is with us in Waukesha. Richard, hi.
Hi. Yeah, in my opinion, if the Republican Party is going to weaponize the filibuster to grind progress to a halt, I think the Democrats should do the same and show the country why it's so dangerous and prevents us from moving forward in any functional way.
Richard, thanks for the call. David, concerns about the weaponizing of the filibuster. Is there something here about a rise in polarization making parties more prone to use the filibuster when they're in the minority in the Senate?
Yeah, I think that's certainly contributing to the increased use of the filibuster, is the increased polarization that we see in Congress right now, in the Senate, where, you know, for many decades, there was pretty big overlap between Democrats and Republicans. There were a lot of Northeastern, you know, called Romney Republicans, Rockefeller Republicans, were the kind of more liberal Republicans. Then you have the Southern Democrats, who were, you know, quite conservative, you know, way to the right of some of those Republicans. So you have a lot of overlap between the two parties up until about the last 20 years or so. And so that definitely coincides with the increased use of the filibuster, is seeing that growing divide between the two parties in the Senate.
Richard, thanks for that call. We're talking to David Cannon, political scientist at UW-Madison, looking at the filibuster in the U.S. Senate. Still time for your thoughts, your opinions, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. David, there have been some changes over the last couple decades in the filibuster when it comes to particular kinds of presidential appointments. What has changed?
Right. The big changes there, we're talking about the exceptions before, with reconciliation being a big one. But the other biggest one is the change that happened with presidential nominations. And so especially with battles over court nominations for both lower court, appeals court nominations, but also for the Supreme Court, where in the history of the Senate, up until President Obama was elected, there were a total of 68 judicial nominations that were subjected to a filibuster. In President Obama's first term, so his first 4 years, there were 79. So in 4 years, there were more filibusters of court nominations than there were in the previous 200 years. And so this led Democrats to say, you know, we're not going to put up this anymore. And they got rid of the filibuster for lower court nominations and for cabinet nominations for the president. And those are now subject to simple majority vote. When the Republicans took over in 2017, they removed also then the filibuster for Supreme Court nominations, something that Democrats had not been willing to do. So now for presidential nominations, both to the federal courts and for cabinet level appointments, those are all not subjected to the filibuster because they did change the Senate rules to allow simple majority vote there.
When you lay it all out like that, David, it feels almost like it's a tiny bit dysfunctional. Is there a better way? Like, can we be doing all this stuff in a better way to actually get stuff done?
Well, yeah. And that's why some people say that the answer would be just to have a simple majority vote rather than having a supermajority for anything. And you would have Senator Sinema's, you know, concern that you might get more volatility and, you know, bouncing back and forth from different policies as the control of the Congress changes from one party to the other. But I think there's more sort of institutional stickiness to policy than that. That it's hard to change status quo policies, especially once they become popular. And look at something like Obamacare. You know, the Republicans talked for years about getting rid of that. But when they had the chance, as you pointed out earlier, John McCain, you know, provided the pivotal vote to say, no, we're not going to change that because, you know, millions of Americans now are benefiting from that policy. And so even if you got rid of the filibuster, I don't think you would get these wild swings back and forth, you know, between different policies if the control of Congress changed parties.
Flipping things around, though, you know, when we get undivided control of government, so a president of one party and then both chambers of Congress, held by the same party, the only tool, the only breaks the minority party has is, in a lot of ways, the filibuster. I don't know. Is either party going to be willing to give up that one failsafe that that they would have if they lost complete control?
Well, right. No, it's a really good point. And that certainly has been used in that way by the minority party when they face unified control of the House, the Senate, and the president in the other party. The filibuster has served as an important tool for the minority party. There's no doubt about that. And so that's the flip side of seeing it as obstruction. The flip side is, well, this is, you know, sticking up for the minority party. And there, obviously, it depends on, you know, if you are in the party that's out of power or the party that's in power. So if you're that minority party that's using the filibuster to stick up for what you believe in, the filibuster is a good thing. If you're on the other side, then it's a bad thing. So no doubt that is historically has been a role for the filibuster in not only the recent past, but going back even further.
Taking outside of the party, if I'm someone who voted for a Republican, say, coming into this current session of Congress, or a Democrat coming into, 2017, without the filibuster, I'm basically completely unrepresented. I have, like, my votes and the people who agreed with me in either of those cases are unrepresented in the federal government in some ways, apart from all the talking.
Right, absolutely. And so that is the role then played by the filibuster. And, you know, take something like voting rights. That's been a very hot issue, you know, since the 2020 election, where, you know, Democrats really pushed that pretty hard to try to enact these federal laws to try to overturn some of the changes that have happened at the state level. And that's what they were trying to change the filibuster for, was to be able to implement those voting rights laws. For the Republicans, you know, they were saying, well, we should be able to implement laws the way we want to at the state level, and having the filibuster then as the tool to protect that at the federal level is definitely an important tool for the minority party.
In our last minute and a half or so, David, what are your thoughts on the future of the filibuster? What kind of changes do you think could actually happen in the next few years?
Yeah, it's given Manchin and Sinema's objections, it's unlikely that they will agree to even what Senator Klobuchar was talking about of the standing or talking filibuster, you know, going back to the previous practice of the higher cost filibuster, if you will. And so I don't think we probably will see that changed, at least, you know, for the rest of this session. Now, if we get, you know, a new majority in the Senate after the midterms of 2022, then we'll see what happens. But I would guess in the next, you know, 4 to 6 years, the filibuster probably will be at least modified to require the standing or talking filibuster.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Good to be with you.
That's David Cannon, political science professor and Leon Epstein faculty fellow at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We talked to him today about the filibuster in the U.S. Senate, how it's changed over time, and as we just heard there, what the future could hold. Still time for you to share your thoughts. You can always tweet us at Central Time WPR. That's at Central Time WPR. And follow us on Twitter while you're there. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, we'll look back on the first year of the Biden administration, the ups and downs, and you can join in with your thoughts on accomplishments and or letdowns. And we'll find out how students of color at UW Green Bay are getting some help from a local barber. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we end the debate over the most amazing statistical performance in U.S. sports history. We'll hear some of your suggestions as well. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Food Friday, cooking can be a stressful chore, but it doesn't always have to be. We'll talk to the author of the new cookbook, Good Enough, about making peace with imperfection in the kitchen and the link between cooking and our mental well-being. First, one of the hallmarks of most sports broadcasts is the statistical trivia. Like, this is only the first time in so many years a player has done this impressive, yet maybe random thing. Here's an example. We hear Bob Uecker on the call.
Here it is. Yelich knocks one to the gap in right center. This could be the one. Ah, he's going to be held to a double. He's trying for three. He's going to do it. Get down. He's in there. Christian Yelich. Ask and you shall receive.
And what was the random impressive stat?
You've done something that no player has done before, and that's hit for the cycle twice against the same team in one season. You're the first to do it. How do you describe what tonight was like?
I don't know. I have no idea how to describe that or what that feels like, but it was pretty awesome, and, you know, you guys are awesome.
That pretty awesome performance was from September of 2018 with the Brewers playing the Cincinnati Reds. Our next guest put together some of the most impressive sports achievements of all time with some numbers to back them up. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. What are some of your most memorable sports moments you've ever seen on TV, in person, or heard on the radio? What did it feel like to experience it live as it happened? Is there a performance in a single game, a single season, or in a career that really stands out in your mind in the sports world? If you're an athlete or former athlete, if you've done something amazing in your sport at whatever level, what did it feel like? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Derek Thompson has been thinking a lot lately about amazing standout sports performances. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic, host of the podcast Plain English, author of the book Hitmakers. His new piece in The Atlantic is out today. It's called What's the Most Amazing Statistical Achievement in U.S. Sports History? Derek, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be here. Thank you so much.
What got you thinking about this specific question, Derek?
That's a great question. What got me thinking about it? I've always been a stat head, to be honest with you. When I was a kid, I liked playing baseball, but I loved memorizing baseball stats. And because I was always like, you know, the eighth best hitter on my team, but always had the deepest reservoir of like random RBI knowledge, sometimes I would just like hang out in the dugout and the coaches would ask me questions like, hey, who is the all-time leader in RBIs? I'd be like, I think it's Hank Aaron. You know, who's the all-time leader in hits? I think it's Ty Cobb or Pete Rose. And I just loved that. And so I guess I basically, you know, have carried that with me into my journalistic career. And on one lazy Saturday afternoon, I just fired up Twitter and I asked Twitter, what do you think is the most statistically unusual sports accomplishment in American sports history? I guess it was inspired by an article that I'd read about Wilt Chamberlain's 100-point game. Obviously, that's legendary. No one's beaten it. But I did a little bit more reading, and it turned out that Chamberlain had more impressive statistics in terms of how they compared to other basketball players. Like, he scored 60 points on 32 separate occasions. The next most on that list is Kobe Bryant with five. So he did 500. Wilt Chamberlain had accomplished that 500% more than any other player. I thought, wow, maybe there's an interesting way to compare stats across sports. You know, any stat that's like 50% greater than the next greatest stat in that category. And I basically gathered all these responses from people on Twitter and then organized them in this article for The Atlantic.
And that's the key. You wanted to try to quantify it, and you admit in your piece, this is kind of an arbitrary way to do it, but it's an interesting one. Talk about that 50% better than anyone else as the milestone, the cutoff for an amazing statistical achievement.
Yeah, everybody has their own subjective definition of amazing. For some people, it's Joe DiMaggio's 56-game hit streak. For some people, it's Cal Ripken's consecutive games played streak. I wanted, though, to have one benchmark that I could use across sports. So the best that I came up with is what I called the 50% club. That is, what sports records are at least 50% greater than the relevant second-place accomplishment. So let's apply the 50% club to Cal Ripken's 2,632 consecutive games played. That's an amazing record. It's a record we should cherish, but it doesn't beat second place by 50%. Lou Gehrig very famously played also in more than 2,000 consecutive games. So it doesn't enter the Hall of Fame, the 50% club that I made up, but it's still very impressive. For a record that does make it into the 50% club, let's think about a Green Bay Packers record.
Great.
Don Hutson's 1942 season, all right? Green Bay Packers wide receiver Don Hutson in 1942 won the Triple Crown in receiving. But he didn't just have the most receptions, yards, and touchdowns. He had more than twice as many receptions, more than twice as many yards, and more than twice as many touchdowns as the next leading receiver in each category. I am not aware of anyone ever in any sport who's won his respective Triple Crown by doubling the totals of the first and second place. So, Cal Ripken, you're an icon, you're legendary, but I'm sorry, Don Hutson makes it into my 50% club, and you do not.
Talking to Derek Thompson from The Atlantic about his new piece, What's the Most Amazing Statistical Achievement in U.S. Sports History? You can join in at 800-642-1234. Not going to make you do the math behind yours. What is a standout athletic performance anywhere in the history of sports? What do you think is the biggest achievement, or what's one that you were really impressed by? Whether in a single game, a single season, or a whole career, join in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Packers may be on your mind this weekend. Is there a moment you'd point back toward in their history, or a stat, or a player, or a career? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Derek, let's go to NFL quarterbacks now. Now, Packer fans could name probably three that they'd put on their greatest of all times list, but But for your statistical benchmark here, we got to look out east to Tom Brady. Why is that?
Well, look, Tom Brady's entire postseason record is just one 50% club ticket after another. I mean, he's played football for so long, and he's made the playoffs so often that basically all of his statistics in the postseason are FPC, 50% club worthy. The best statistic that I found, this is from Boston sports radio host Alex Barth. This is just ridiculous. I'm quoting from Alex here. So, quote, the NFL record for career completions is 67.8%. Tom Brady has made the conference championship 73.7% of the seasons he's been the primary starter. So Tom Brady makes the conference championship at a rate higher than any quarterback completes passes, end quote. Like, what? That doesn't make any sense. It's crazy. So, of course, Brady has the most playoff games. He has the most playoff wins. He has the most playoff touchdowns. The greatest playoff comeback in history. He has number one, 25 points against the Falcons. I think he also has number two, 10 points against the Seahawks. Basically, every single postseason statistic for quarterbacks. Look, Aaron Rodgers is extraordinary. Brett Favre is extraordinary. Bart Scott, like, you guys have an extraordinary history of quarterbacks in Green Bay. But Tom Brady's postseason record is the Mount Kilimanjaro that soars above the plains of everybody else's postseason history.
Let's bring out a caller now at 800-642-1234. Looking for your favorite moments, favorite achievements in the sports world. Susie is with us in Williams Bay. Susie, hi.
Hi there. I think for an individual thing, I would say Kirk Gibson's home run when he had the bad leg. Mm. And I think as far as like a dominating performance, I would say Eric Heiden in the Olympics with speed skating, or Mark Spitz swimming in the Olympics.
Ooh.
And also Secretariat winning the Triple Crown.
Great ideas there, Susie. I was there once for a Kirk Gibson home run when he played for the Tigers. It was a unique game that might be in the 50% club. Three bench-clearing brawls. They almost had to call the game because they were out of players. They both sides had nine, and Kirk Gibson ended up winning it with a home run. Very memorable. You, I don't know if you looked at those in particular, Derek, but you did look at one Olympic one, Simone Biles.
Yeah, I looked at Simone Biles. Simone Biles is punched her ticket into the 50% club. Her 19 world championship gold medals is almost twice as many as any other female gymnast. She also, by the way, has the most total world medals of any gymnast, male or female. She is in the club. There's another Olympic record that I am totally fascinated by and made it into sort of the waiting room outside of the club. Bob Beamon's record-breaking long jump at the 1968 Summer Olympics in Mexico City. I did not know this story, but I'll tell it briefly because I really went down an internet rabbit hole understanding what happened in Mexico City in 1968. So in the 1960s, new long jump records were typically set by anywhere between half an inch and an inch, 2 inches. Bob Beamon in 1968 broke the all-time record by 22 inches. He broke the all-time record by 10 times more than people typically break records. The jump was so long that it famously forced the officials to stop the Olympics briefly so that they could find new measuring equipment to bring out to the sand and measure what had just happened. When Bob Beamon learned that he'd broken the record by almost 2 feet, he was so emotional that he collapsed and experienced what doctors later called a cataplectic seizure. So Beamon can't make it into the FPC officially because his record set in 1968 was eventually broken at another world championship. But it does, in fact, remain today the longest standing Summer Olympic record of modern times. So Bob Beamon's record-breaking long jump, not technically in the 50% club, but absolutely should be a sports movie.
And he did recover from that seizure, right?
And he did, I should say.
Don't want to leave people hanging there.
Sorry, thank you.
That's Derek Thompson, staff writer for The Atlantic. He has a new piece called What's the Most Amazing Statistical Achievement in U.S. Sports History? He has a ruler to use to see what really stands out. You could share yours, math or no, at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the achievements we've talked about so far? What stands out to you in your sports watching or sports participating history as a great standout achievement from an individual athlete, a whole team? One moment, one game, one season, one career? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about the most amazing and memorable U.S. sports achievements in history with Derek Thompson, staff writer for The Atlantic. You can join in with your nominations at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Back to your calls now. Yordis is with us in Colfax. Hi, Yordis.
Hi. I think that Tom Brady's records should be looked at more carefully because he cheated. He had the scandal where people were deflating the footballs, which makes it easier to throw and easier to catch. And we really don't know how long that was going on and whether that affected his statistics. And also, when he was with New England, they were using video equipment to steal signals during many of those Super Bowl runs. We don't know, I mean, at least I don't, how long that was going on before it was discovered. So I guess I think there should be an asterisk next to Tom Brady that people call him the greatest of all time, but I'd say he's the greatest cheater of all time.
Yordis, thanks for the call. Strong words, Derek. Do you want to put an asterisk by Tom Brady's name?
I'm going to decline to put an asterisk by Tom Brady's name. I have thoughts about Deflategate that are definitely too long to air in the middle of a segment that is about the entire history of American sports accomplishments. I will simply, because my job here is to represent statistics, represent a statistic. The Deflate Game was, well, first off, let me say this. I'm a Peyton Manning fan, okay? I'm not a Tom Brady fan. I'm a Peyton Manning fan, and it gives me no pleasure to rattle off any positive statistics about Tom Brady. I liked his rival. That said, the Deflategate game was January 18th, 2015. Tom Brady won three more Super Bowls after 2015. He won in 2017, he won in 2019, and he won in 2021 as a 43-year-old. So even if you did want to throw out all of the Super Bowl wins from Tom Brady before 2015, you're still left with someone who has more Super Bowl wins, or excuse me, as many Super Bowl wins, I believe, as almost any quarterback other than, what, Joe Montana, who maybe has four? So Brady's career is an extraordinarily long, extraordinarily successful career, and what he's doing into his 40s has no equivalent in sports history from a Super Bowl-winning standpoint.
Thanks for the call, Yordis. Before I go back to our callers, one that I think a lot of people would put an asterisk on made your list, and you talk about this, Barry Bonds' early 2000 stats, including his intentional walk numbers.
Yeah, this is another one where, if the caller wanted to complain about my inclusion of Barry Bonds and his steroid use, admitted steroid use, I would grant that. Look, I don't know what to do with Barry Bonds' stats in terms of, say, letting him into the Hall of Fame. I don't know what to do with his stats as a benchmark of morality, but all I can do is analyze statistics, and these statistics don't make any sense. Barry Bonds' 2001-2004 seasons are one of the most extraordinary runs by any player in any sport. And my favorite statistic about Barry Bonds' early 2000s is his intentional walk record. Barry Bonds broke the record for most intentional walks in baseball history was 45 set by Willie McCovey in 1969. Bonds broke that in 2002 with 68. Then he broke it again in 2004 with 120. So he tripled, essentially, the intentional walk record. He has so many intentional walk records because, essentially, by the time he was putting up these numbers in 2004, pitchers didn't even want to face him when they were losing. They didn't want to face him when the bases were loaded. So he was walked in all sorts of extraordinary circumstances that create a bunch of different hilariously complex records, which I talk about in the article and won't go into detail here. But basically, people know Barry Bonds for the hitting. They know him for the on-base percentage. But the record that really shatters everything else is the intentional walk record.
Let's go back to your calls now. Bob is with us in Madison. Bob, hi.
Thank you. This is a college athlete, quarterback at Marshall University, my alma mater. Byron Leftwich, who injured his leg, could not walk. Yet they kept him in the games all season, and his role was to pass, complete a pass, get picked up by two linemen, carried down the field to the next scrimmage line, pass, be picked up by two linemen, get carried down the field, and he did that and won game after game after game, being unable to walk at all, except he did make one run. He made a first down by hopping for a yard and a half on one leg. That is the year that he was also nominated for the Heisman Trophy. And I think right now he's being considered for a coaching position at the Chicago Bears.
Bob, thanks. Well, that's suffering there if he takes that. Bob, thanks for the call, though, from your alma mater. That's something that's harder, Derek, to get that gutsy performance. The stats might not show it, but the story sure can.
Yeah, maybe the right statistic is largest ever comeback with a broken shin, because Byron Leftwich broke his left tibia, came back into the game, and then rallied his team down 17 against Akron. This was in November 2002. Ironically, Byron Leftwich is now the coach of Tom Brady. So I guess it all comes back. It all comes back to Brady. Also, rather remarkably, Byron Leftwich is younger than Tom Brady, even though he's coaching him. So yeah, a lot of fun records, I suppose, on the Tampa Bay Bucks. But you probably want me to move off of fun Tampa Bay Buck records in the next few seconds. So we can go back to the callers or sure. Back to the article.
Bob, thanks a lot for the call. Dave joins us now in La Crosse. Dave, hi.
Hey, how you doing today?
Good. What's your nomination or nominations, Dave?
Well, my nomination is a little bit different, but I'll explain it a little bit. You know, so many of the incidents and players that you're talking about didn't necessarily rejoice all the people that were watching those teams, but this particular team did. It was the Miracle on Ice, the ice hockey for the Olympics that reunited this nation, excited people. They were all watching and made a huge difference nationwide in exactly what sports should be. It was a team that was statistically eliminated from beating that Russian team, but overcame all obstacles and won a hockey game that reunited a nation.
Dave, thanks a lot for the call. Derek, again, this one might not show up in your statistical memory, but it definitely stands strong in Dave's memory.
Yeah, it's interesting. It can be tough to find room for teams, because team mm-hmm. statistics are a little bit harder than individual statistics. The one that I have here, other than what I've mentioned, is I apologize, because this is another Packer rival. In fact, a very proximate Packer rival. The 1989 San Francisco 49ers. Won 18 consecutive road games between 1988 and 1990. That's exactly 50% more than the second place New England Patriots, who won 12 straight road games in 2017. And also in the middle of that streak, the 49ers won the 1990 Super Bowl by the largest margin in history. So I discovered those statistics, which get into the 50% club, by trying to run down some stats about Jerry Rice. But who did not himself make it into the club. But the team stats are sometimes a little bit harder to come by, because there's just a lot more stats that we attach to individuals.
Derek, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Derek Thompson, staff writer for The Atlantic. We talked to him about his new piece for the magazine. It's out today. It's called What's the Most Amazing Statistical Achievement in U.S. Sports History? Got some of the examples from the piece. You can find more online at theatlantic.com. Coming up after the news on this week's edition of Food Friday, we'll talk to a cookbook author about letting go of perfectionism in the kitchen. I've done that. And using cooking as a means of self-care. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.